This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Jazz pianist George Shearing turned 80 earlier this year. He's celebrating with a birthday concert at Carnegie Hall next Tuesday. We're going to hear a 1986 interview with him. Shearing was born in London and was blind from birth. In the 1940s, he was one of England's most popular jazz musicians. But after World War II, he decided to move to New York, the center of modern jazz. He became an American citizen in 1956. This was the decade in which he enjoyed his greatest commercial success. Let's listen to his quintet's recording of his best-known composition, Lullaby of Birdland. Shearing recorded in 1952. Shearing now records for the Telarc label. When I spoke with him in 1986, he told me that as a child, he studied piano at a school for the blind. I asked him if his teachers were confident that a blind person could master the piano.
I don't think it's a question of whether a blind child could master the piano as whether a blind child can make a living in anything other than playing in the pubs, which is where I started. You've got to remember one thing, Terry, and that is that if I chose, say, to be a studio musician, it's obviously necessary to read music. And yes, I can read Braille music, but that's not sight reading, sighted music. You might find 30 pages of manuscript paper with so many notes on it, just as if, you know, flies were all over it. And we always say that there are some sighted people who read so well that if a fly appeared on the paper, they'd read it, you know. This is not available to the blind. But playing in the pub was, and eventually getting my own group was. And from there, I went with an all-blind band, 15 blind guys, learning to play instruments from being basket makers and chair caners. We were playing arrangements of Jimmy Lunsford and Duke Ellington and people like that.
How did you find each other? Who organized the band?
The National Institution for the Blind. People used to write all the parts out in Braille. I was the only one who didn't read his part. I could pick it up by ear because I learned a lot of the records as well. There were a couple of people in that band, the first trumpet player and the drummer, who had everything from, early Miff Mole and stuff like that, all the way through Teddy Wilson and Tatum and Fats Waller. And these people all kind of became my mentors, as you can imagine. So it was that was a really wonderful training ground.
Just as you were really coming of age and, well, you'd already started your recording career, the war came along. How was the music scene in London changed by the war, and was there any place to perform or even places to listen during the war?
I had more work than I could handle because there were so many people called up. I would be doing studio work in the daytime because there was enough of it that didn't demand reading, and they couldn't afford to be that fussy any longer. So I learned the charts and did the recordings and the jazz broadcasts and whatever was involved. I did theater, two shows in the theater, 8 and 10 at night. I went on to a supper club and played from 10:30 until about 1:30, and then on to a nightclub and played till 4, and then back in the studios the next morning at 10. I had much more work than I could handle.
Were you ever bombed while you were performing during the war?
Oh, yes. First of all, my mother was bombed out 3 times. And I was in a cab one night going to work, and we stopped at a traffic light. We heard this tremendous blast, and the cab shook like mad, And I said, boy, that was a close one, wasn't it? And there was no answer. And I said, that was a close one, wasn't it? And I put my hand in front, and the driver's gone. He ducked in a doorway, and when it was all clear, he came out again. I said, thanks a lot.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, didn't you also do some playing inside air raid shelters during the
war? Oh, yes.
What kind of setup was that there'd be a piano there?
I met my first wife in an air raid shelter. And what we did, we played in the basement, which had been turned into a gymnasium. And there were kind of forms, you know, benches that one could sleep on or on the floor, and there were blankets and stuff. And there would be an upright piano there. So I was living with a song plugger at the time, and he and I would play four hands, much to the amusement of people that went, you know, down in that particular air raid shelter.
So you think it helped pass the time for everybody?
Oh, yeah. Oh, well, sure. I mean, you had to make a life. I mean, you had no alternative. 15 hours a day, the raid would be on. Day and night, until we defeated the day raiders.
My guest is pianist George Shearing. Well, after the war, you decided, I guess, not to stay in London, and you wanted to at least make a few trips to the United States. What was the lure of America for you?
I met a few American musicians just before and a few more during the war. And all as if they were in one voice, pretty well said, man, you should go over to the States. You kill them over there. Well, you know, I had acquired some ability to play in the styles of Teddy Wilson, Art Tatum, Fats Waller, and Bob Zirke, and people like that. But they had all this over here. You can't believe, when I first came over on the U.S., on the United States ship, I had letters to top flight agents, and I went around giving one audition after another. It became very evident to me very quickly that what I needed was an identity. And the identity was, of course, the George Shearing Quintet.
We'll hear more of our archive interview with George Shearing after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our 1986 interview with pianist George Shearing.
It seems to me that in the last few years, you've been adding more and more popular song to your repertoire, playing with singers like Mel Torme, singing yourself. You've recently, I think it's recently, began singing.
Yeah, within
singing
the last 10
well.
Or 15 years, you know, recently, yeah.
What attracts you to a song when
lyrics,
you're shooting it?
Lyrics. And how the lyrics fit with the music. You know, and being able to make literary sense out of the song. For instance, everybody, and I do mean everybody that I've heard, when they do Send in the Clowns, they sing, isn't it rich, isn't it queer, losing my timing this late in my career. Now, would you say it that way? Losing my timing this late in my career? You would say, losing my timing this late in my career, wouldn't you? But it's partly Sondheim's fault. I love him. I love him dearly. We had a long talk one night in the Carlisle about Bach. He's a great Bach enthusiast. But people have to use a little bit of imagination, a little bit of ingenuity. Isn't it rich? Isn't it queer? Losing my timing this late in my career. This is why I love songs.
I see what you mean with that. Did Sondheim agree with you?
I think so. In fact, I know he did, yes. Yes, he agreed with me completely.
You've written songs as well, and I think your best-known piece is Lullaby of Birdland. Can you tell us the story behind writing that?
Birdland needed a theme song for a six-hour disc jockey show that they had in the early 50s.
And Birdland was a club, in
yeah.
New York
mm-hmm.
in the 50s?
Right. Yes.
Mostly bop musicians played
right.
it.
Right, yeah. Well, it was named for Charlie Parker, see. whose nickname was Bert. So I wrote this thing. I heard it in my head. I wrote it in 10 minutes. I always say 10 minutes and 35 years in the business. Over a steak in my dining room when I lived in New Jersey. I went back to that same butcher 1,000 times trying to get that same steak again. So they liked it, and they played it every hour on the hour, which is, of course, why it became my best-known song, because Macklemore is my only well-known song. You know, when I go on as a composer, I said, I'd like to play you a medley of my hit, you know. But the thing is that when something is hammered through people's heads, like, of course it's going to, if it's got any substance at all that people can hang on to, of course it's going to become a hit, you know. And that's what happened with Lullaby. And, of course, we got over 100 people recording it.
I don't know if you wrote it with a lyric in mind or not, but
no.
I have heard it sung.
Yes.
And the first line is, I'm not going to sing it, maybe you'll do it, but they sing the first line with Lullaby of Birdland in it.
Yes, they do.
Do you want to just sing the line just to?
Yeah. Well, if you read it and you read it as if you're dividing the lines, you say, Lullaby of Birdland, that's what I always hear when you sigh. Never in my wordland could there be ways to reveal in a phrase how I feel. Well, doesn't mean anything, does it, really? So, Lullaby of Birdland, that's what I always hear when you sigh. Never in my wordland could there be ways to reveal in a phrase how I feel. Now, it means something because it's being read.
Did you, when you composed the song, hear the first phrase as being Lullaby of Birdland?
No. No. I just thought of this as a tune. And in fact, I'm not even sure that, I mean, it was a theme song for Birdland. I don't even remember who gave it the title of Lullaby of Birdland.
When you first started living in the States in the 40s and the 50s, the jazz scene was having, jazz musicians were really having a lot of drug problems. There was a lot of heroin that was being used among jazz musicians then, and a lot of young musicians, partially, I think, to emulate some of their heroes like Charlie Parker, ended up shooting up and getting hooked on drugs. Did you ever run into any problems with that or come close to it? Was it hard for you to keep out of that?
Oh, no. I didn't drink. I didn't take a glass of wine until I was 46 years old. Never mind drugs or anything like that. I had people with me that took it. And provided they did their job, showed up on time and played as well as they would not. And that's a lot to ask. But if they could do it, it wasn't my business. I had a guy one night, and I'll protect him. I won't tell you his name. He called me about 3 o'clock in the morning. And he said, George, can I come up and see you for a minute? And I thought the manager had forgot to pay him or something, you know. So he came up. He sat on my bed. And he said, George. I said, yeah. Bob, what's the matter? I'm on drugs. And he cried. And I said, so you're on drugs? Now, what? What does that mean? And he told me that he didn't want to stay around long enough for the shame to mar my band and my reputation. And I said, when you are straight, your job will be there. Well, time went on, and we never did get together again. And I understand he is very straight now. But I also understand that he's not playing anymore and that he's teaching, doing something. So I hope he is. But you see, he was guilty enough. He felt guilty enough. What am I going to do? I'm not his keeper. I can't use them when they're like that and when they're not doing the job.
Had you realized that he was on drugs? And did you consider saying, oh, that's okay, you can stay, you're still performing?
I just thought his playing was kind of weak.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't really do the job I imagined he could do. But I still waited, you know, in case he was going through a period of natural, you know, just not feeling up to par or something. And I'm patient, you know. But everybody protected him, of course. Wonderful group, you know.
You mentioned that you didn't drink, you didn't even have a glass of wine until you were 46.
Right.
Why not? Why not have some wine or an occasional drink?
My mother drank more beer than she needed to drink. And in the neighborhood that I lived in, I saw a lot of, although my family were not involved, I saw a lot of street fighting and a lot of stuff going on, and I didn't need it. I was afraid. I didn't want to be involved in anything less than a life where I could really know where I was, you know, coming from. And, you know, to this very day, I'm very conscious about knowing, you know, what's going on at all times.
What made you think then at age 46 that it was okay at that point to have a drink? Did you feel secure enough within yourself
so that you
knew you could drink in moderation?
I think that was probably it, yeah.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us about your life and your playing today. Thank you very much for being here.
And thank you. I hope we see you again.
Pianist George Shearing, recorded in 1986. Next Tuesday, he'll perform an 80th birthday concert at Carnegie Hall. Here's his 1975 recording of Happy Days Are Here Again. George Shearing, this is Fresh Air.